For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook, and visit arsenalfordemocracy.com to read the articles referenced in this episode. This is Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island, the Redwood Forest, the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. We're recording this episode on Sunday, March 15th, 2020, in the evening. Joining me this week is Rachel. Hello, Rachel. How are you?
Hi, Bill. I'm doing well.
So this is actually our 300th episode, according to the counting system that we use for these episodes. There's probably been some give or take one way or the other special episodes that weren't counted for whatever reasons. But this is the nominal 300th episode of our show. Usually in the past, we had done something special for the 100 ones or whatever, or had a big guest on. But this is a rather chaotic period that we're recording this in, as we are at a sort of strange flux point in the presidential primaries, but also the coronavirus pandemic appears to be taking down planet Earth. Last week, we did a specifically focused episode on coronavirus, in part because my co-host Rachel is a microbiologist who specializes in infectious diseases, although not this particular variety of infectious diseases. But we were mostly talking about, you know, what people can expect, how they should prepare, that sort of thing. This week, however, we're going to go with a more historical focus, obviously with some lessons learned as usual. You might recall over the summer, we did a lot of episodes about the period around World War I. So we're going to be returning to that. And of course, unsurprisingly, talking about Spanish flu. So Rachel, let us talk this week about Spanish flu and what we can learn from that pandemic, especially because in many ways, it was overshadowed by World War I, and so therefore some of the lessons that should have been learned by the public maybe weren't learned by the public at the time because people kind of forgot about it as much more significant things were happening. I mean, half the major governments in the world collapsed like a year later for unrelated reasons. Talk to me about what the Spanish flu itself was, when it happened, the course of that disease, etc.
Right. So the Spanish flu pandemic happened over a period of about 2 years. So from 1918 to about 1920, there's some give or take. I would probably put the end of 1917 in there and perhaps the beginning of 1921 in there as well. So let's start with the name, Spanish flu. The reason it is called the Spanish flu, it didn't originate in Spain, as far as people are aware. It didn't hit Spain especially hard compared to other countries in the world. But because of the World War I that was going on, or the Great War, the media in those countries that were participating in the war was kind of on lockdown. They were either under governmental censorship or self-censorship to keep morale up, I guess. And so they didn't want to report on this flu epidemic that was happening because that would make people scared and uncertain of the future. And so the only country that was actually reporting on the flu and how the infection was spreading was Spain. And so over time, it just kind of became associated with Spain, even though it was happening all over the world at that time. So that's kind of an interesting thing. I didn't actually know that tidbit until I started doing research about 2 years ago around the the 100-year anniversary of the pandemic.
And remarkably, they were actually so transparent that Alfonso XIII, the king of Spain, contracted the flu that we now call Spanish flu, and they publicized that information. They didn't even try to keep that a secret. And he was far from the only world leader that got it. The president-elect of Brazil ended up dying of the Spanish flu as well. But as you said, this is something that, you know, they weren't censoring in Spain in this particular time, and they were being remarkably transparent about it, and therefore it was not, you know, it became associated with Spain, even though they were sort of, you know, they weren't even, I don't even know if they got hit necessarily by the first wave or whatever, which we'll talk about that, but there was, you know, certainly the media attention coming out of Spain kind of crystallized around that.
Another thing I really wanted to highlight that I wasn't aware of in the beginning before I started doing research is that there were actually two different waves of flu. So in the beginning stage, so probably late 1917, early 1918, there was actually a flu wave that wasn't quite as virulent, and it seemed to spread extremely rapidly. So that first wave didn't end up killing a lot of people. However, there was a second wave in the fall of 1918, and that actually was the deadliest time period for the pandemic. The vast majority of deaths were packed into about 3 months in the fall of 1918. Historians now believe that this wave was caused by a mutated virus spread by wartime troop movements. So people were kind of actively going against how normal peacetime containment happens. So in peacetime, people get sick, they stay home, they avoid spreading the disease and transmitting it to other people. However, when troops were getting sick, they would get taken off the battlefield, out of their army camps or whatever, and put on a train to get taken to the hospital. So a whole bunch of people with various illnesses were getting packed into a closed train car and getting taken to hospitals. So that was a very easy way for the flu to transmit from person to person. There was close contact between a lot of sick people, immunocompromised people, people suffering from malnutrition or bacterial infections. And so they were immunocompromised, and they succumbed to this second wave of flu. This second wave obviously traveled from troops to civilians because they were moving around and coming in contact with lots and lots of people. So they were just able to transmit this everywhere. So in late August 1918, military ships departed the English port city of Plymouth, carrying troops infected with this new strain of Spanish flu. And then these ships arrived in cities like Brest in France, Boston in the United States, and Freetown in South Africa. And that kind of sparked the second wave of the global pandemic. This is on a history.com article that kind of goes over the second wave. So there's a quote from a historian, James Harris. He's a historian at The Ohio State University who studies both infectious disease and World War I. He believes that the rapid spread of Spanish flu in the fall of 1918 was at least partially to blame on public health officials unwilling to impose quarantines during wartime. In Britain, for example, a government official named Arthur Newsholm knew full well that a strict civilian lockdown was the best way to fight the spread of this disease, but he wouldn't risk crippling the war effort by keeping munitions factory workers and other civilians home. Newsholm concluded that, quote, "The relentless needs of warfare justified incurring the risk of spreading infection, and he encouraged Britons to simply carry on during the pandemic." There's also a really poor public health response in the United States because there was a severe nursing shortage because thousands of nurses had been deployed to military camps in the front lines. The shortage was worsened by the American Red Cross's refusal to use trained African-American nurses until the worst of the pandemic had already passed. So that's basically what not to do during a global pandemic. Don't just carry on as normal. Don't try to keep people working during these times of disease. and make sure there's plenty of nurses available to treat sick people.
Also, don't be racist. It's a global pandemic. It affects everyone. Every time there's a pandemic, people try to be like, those people over there are doing something wrong. That means that they're going to get sick and we're not. And that is never true. It always ends up spreading to everybody.
Right. That's just the most irrational thing you can probably do in response to a global health pandemic. I think there's definitely some lessons that we can learn today from the response to the Spanish flu pandemic.
Yeah. Can you talk specifically about the lessons learned from Philadelphia? That was sort of a case study along with St. Louis in terms of what to do or not to do.
Yeah. So in Philadelphia, they were having a Liberty Loan Parade the end of September in 1918. However, the virus had already spread to Philadelphia on September 19th through the Philadelphia Navy Yard, according to information from the University of Pennsylvania's Archives and Records Center. In a matter of days, 600 sailors had the virus. Yet Philadelphia chose not to cancel that parade. So it was meant to be a patriotic wartime effort, probably like a morale booster. So the parade went on as scheduled on September 28th, which brought 200,000 Philadelphians together. Just a few days later, on October 1st, there were already 635 new cases in Philadelphia. Philadelphia became one of the hardest hit U.S. cities. More than 12,000 people died in 6 weeks with about 47,000 reported cases. By the 6 month mark, about 16,000 people had died and there were more than 500,000 cases. That's what not to do. St. Louis was also supposed to have a parade. However, they canceled their parade while Philadelphia let theirs go on.
They canceled almost everything else. They shut down the bars and restaurants very quickly after like one case was reported in St. Louis.
Yep, exactly. So by the end, due to those efforts, the death toll in St. Louis did not rise above 700. So 700 versus 16,000. So that example shows the benefit of canceling mass gatherings and employing social distancing measures during pandemics, the CDC said.
Can you talk about that aspect that just in that last line there about the social distancing? I think we talked a little bit about it last week, but I feel like maybe we didn't hit it hard enough in terms of explaining what it is and also why it's called that, because I feel like people are maybe confused about that.
So, yeah, I think social distancing, it is what it says. Basically, we don't want large groups congregating for social purposes. So going to bars, restaurants, movie theaters, any concerts, any place where large groups of people are gathering together and just being in close contact with a lot of people. That's definitely something we need to look at our practices and look at ways we can prevent transmission. I heard somebody say it best. Even if you know you're not infected, just act like you are infected and think about the people in your life that you don't want to transmit a disease to. I think a lot of people are taking it to mean like isolate yourself totally and don't even talk to people. But that's obviously not what it means. Just especially given now with our technology, there are ways to have social interactions with people, but just don't have those face to face. I also think a lot of people don't really know what a quarantine is or how to adhere to a quarantine. I've heard stories about people like family members who have gotten sick, but then their relatives leave the house and go out and interact with the community. That's not how you do a quarantine. So the whole household basically needs to go on lockdown and needs to not go out in the public. And I think that's something that a lot of people are hesitant to do because I think there's this, like, I think in the case of Philadelphia, like, you want to act like everything's normal. You don't want to panic and blah, blah, blah. But I think there's definitely a smarter way to keep a stiff upper lip or like to show that your spirits are high without endangering the people around you.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about this off air before we started. The whole, Blitz era, keep calm and carry on stuff that has been revived in the age of the global war on terror. This is an RNA strand. It's not trying to scare you. It's fine if you are feeling scared, but the objective of the virus is to reproduce itself. It does not have a brain. It is not trying to psychologically torment you or whatever. That's not how it reproduces either. People are treating this like, oh, the terrorists, you know, if we stop our daily life, then the terrorists have won. It's like, it's not terrorists. This is a disease, and it doesn't really care. Does not care about your feelings. The keep calm and carry on stuff was brought back for that sort of psychological purpose in the modern era, except that's not what it meant at the time. This is what we were talking about before we recorded. Like, if you think about the instructions in the era of the Blitz in London, I mean, Rachel, you were saying this, right? You were still supposed to put up blackout curtains. You were still supposed to report to your, you know, tube station or whatever for shelter during an air raid, that kind of thing. And it seems like people are not really internalizing that that is the more relevant comparison. Like the idea where everything does shut down, life does essentially shut down, or at least partially shuts down. And you have to make some significant changes in how you conduct your life in order to survive. Also, a lot of people didn't survive the Blitz. And in many cases, it was not following the directions and the orders and things like that, and just trying to ride it out. You have to, this is a situation where the brave thing to do, the thing that is going to show your resolve in the face of this crisis, is to isolate yourself, not spread this virus, etc. That's the thing that you should be doing to show that you haven't completely gone into a tailspin about this or whatever.
Right. I think we definitely need to find ways to keep our spirits up. Like, I've been watching movies or whatever. And so that's definitely something that we can think about. There's still ways to find entertainment and to not panic, but just kind of flouting the rules and like ignoring medical advice is like the absolute worst thing that people can do right now.
Yeah, people tried that in Italy, and there's a rapidly climbing death toll as a result of that. Can you talk about, there was a couple of other articles that you have in the notes. As usual, the notes will be up at arsenalfordemocracy.com. There was a couple things that you had notes on in terms of lessons learned, again, from the Spanish flu. Because I don't want to go too far into the current thing, again, given the fact that every 24 hours it's getting significantly worse. So by the time this comes out, the situation will be completely different. So let's get back to lessons learned here. There was obviously some thought, not just because of the 100th anniversary a couple years ago of the Spanish flu, but also just in general a few years ago, people trying to think about particular, you know, infectious disease, pandemic risks and that sort of thing. Talk to me about some of these things in terms of preparation and steps that can be taken, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So I think another aspect of the Spanish flu that made it so so widely spread is just how mobile people were. There were obviously a lot of troop movements, supply movements, just a lot of people moving from country to country. And although we're not in a traditional wartime setting, I think people are just definitely more mobile than ever. There's a lot of people traveling internationally. And so I think that kind of mirrors the threat that existed 100 years ago. Keith Kay, the president of the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America and professor of internal medicine and infectious diseases at University of Michigan, said, "We are probably a plane ride away from a major threat in the U.S. That sounds overly dramatic, but it's true. One positive development that I've seen related to preparedness, fueled by Ebola and conjointly with recognition of antimicrobial resistance and the CRE threat, which is carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae." I can explain that later, or to anyone who's interested, if you DM me or whatever. Is a greater regional effort through joint hospital and public health partnerships. I've noticed many more joint initiatives around either preparedness for pandemics or emerging infections, as well as for more commonly encountered resistant organisms like CRE or Acinetobacter or even MRSA and VRE. One advantage that we have compared to 5 years ago is stronger collegiality and cohesiveness between public health and healthcare, which puts us in a much better position to combat pathogens such as Ebola or SARS. Very prescient there.
Yeah, given that SARS. This is SARS too. Yeah, those things that you were mentioning that you said people could ask you about later. I mean, the brief, that those are super bugs, right? Like bacterial, what is it? They're
antimicrobial resistant.
Yeah, they're resistant. Bacteria. Yeah, they're resistant to antibacterial stuff. Yes. Okay. Yeah. That's the brief version of that.
And there's also a research article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America titled Public Health Interventions and Epidemic Intensity During the 1918 Influenza Pandemic. So I'm just going to kind of go over their discussion at the end of the article. So they compared 17 U.S. cities that employed different non-pharmaceutical interventions, such as closing schools, churches, playhouses, movie theaters, banning mass gatherings. Cities that show the first peak in excess pneumonia and influenza death rates during the fall wave of the 1918 influenza pandemic was approximately 50% lower in cities that implemented multiple of those NPIs to control disease spread early in their epidemics than in cities that made such interventions late or not at all. This finding suggests that such interventions may be capable of significantly reducing the rate of disease transmission so long as they remain in effect. So I think the sooner that cities deploy these interventions, the better. I know a lot of people think they may be overkill or they may be overreacting, but I think people think that because when you do deploy them and they work, nothing happens. So then it does look like an overreaction. However, we have learned where these interventions are not put in place, it can be so much worse. So I think this is something I've kind of said over and over again as somebody in public health. If we're doing our jobs, you don't notice us. So I think that's something that can make people look overzealous. But the proof is in the fact that we do look overzealous versus reactionary and too late.
Well, and also it just seems like there's too much focus right now on trying to keep the quote unquote economy open.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I'm sorry, but at a certain point, we can't keep it open. I mean, you gotta have people stay at home or else it's just gonna, you know, everything's gonna fall apart anyway. So.
Right. And it's definitely gotten worse over the last 100 years. We have just tied so much of our economic well-being to like these, I don't know, intangible things like finance or the stock market or whatever. So I think this is something that we are definitely focusing more on now than we did in 1918. The fact that like, oh, if I cut the federal interest rate, maybe everything won't crash. But I think we're already past that point, and these interventions aren't actually helping people in the short term and where they are at right now. I think
also we've got a much more urban population that does not work in agriculture. People sometimes forget that even in 1920 and 1918, the U.S. was still significantly had large sections of the population working in agriculture and living in rural areas that were more dispersed from each other. So we are in a different situation now.
Yeah. So I think what really needs to happen is making sure that people's material needs are met where we are at now. So things like, I think instead of cutting the federal interest rate, I think the government should be really considering actually giving checks to people. That is something that is well within the scope of the government. I never experienced it, but I remember during the Bush 2 years, everybody got a check when the taxes were cut. So that is something that can definitely happen right now. Just give money to people.
Right. And it can't be just a payroll tax cut because right. Not everyone gets taxes withdrawn from their pay. Two groups of people that don't in large numbers are contractors and people who only get paid based on the hours that they work as, you know, hourly wage workers rather than a fixed salary. If they don't punch in, they don't get paid. And so that's not a viable solution. Like, you're going to have to do some sort of a universal basic, essentially stipend to stay home, at least as a temporary measure. Because people are going to still have to pay their bills. Like,
right. Yeah. And I've seen things like moratoria on evictions. I think that's great. I think it needs to be more widespread. I know like jurisdictionally, it's different from state to state or
even county to county. Yeah.
Right. So I think that's something we definitely need to consider. It's time. Yeah. I think we have reached the breaking point. So we need to really consider what our government is for, the role of the government during these emergencies, how to keep people going. I think it's definitely time to think about these social programs and how much they've been slashed. Like, we don't have a traditional welfare system or a traditional like sick leave system. So I think that's something we definitely need to look at in the coming months and years.
And again, we're avoiding going too far into depth about the current situation on where we're at on some of these things, just because, again, we are recording this on the evening of Sunday, March 15th, and stuff is changing every 12 to 24 hours. This isn't going to come out immediately, so we don't want to get too specific on things that are going to be out of date by the time this episode even airs. Anyway, I will leave it there. As usual, arsenalfordemocracy.com. We post the with each episode a PDF that has all the links and notes of what we were talking about and looking at. Rachel, thank you again for coming on this week to talk about Spanish flu and coronavirus.
Thanks, Bill. Always a pleasure.